So let me just introduce myself. I'm Claudia Chofan, and I, with the University of California in San Francisco, with the Institute for Health and Aging, and I'm an assistant professor of health policy and sociology there. So my presentation today is entitled, "You Must Not Confuse Poverty with Laziness," and you'll soon find out why I called it that way. And this is a case study of the power of discourse to reproduce diabetes inequalities. I didn't get on time that, or I actually omitted the disclaimer slide. I have no conflicts of interest to disclose. The goal of my study was to investigate the ideological work of ways of speaking, which I call discourse, in the reproduction of health inequalities, although at the beginning of my investigation, I didn't know that was going to be the goal. I set out to do something different, just so that I communicate what I mean by my use of particular words. Discourse I take to be a system of language and conventions that make a field of knowledge possible, and I use ideology in the Marxian sense as a frame, a worldview that serves elite interests, even though it may be accepted and upheld by all segments of society. So why did I choose diabetes to investigate health inequalities generally? Well, in my opinion, diabetes is a good disease to study health inequalities generally, because diabetes inequalities themselves, and even diabetes itself, as well as its complications, strongly depends upon access to social resources that require a certain amount of social power to achieve access to healthy lifestyles, good medical care, and so forth. There's other reasons why I chose type 2 diabetes. It's my long-standing personal experience with the disease in a variety of capacities, included, not limited to, my former career as a physician in Argentina, my place of birth, my country of birth. I also have had a substantial amount of exposure to, that should say, diabetes inequalities, not health inequalities, diabetes inequalities among Latinos, as I trained as a sociologist in the United States. Now, why did I choose Latinos? Well, Latinos, as you probably know, are at high risk for diabetes and its complications, 1.5 to 3 roughly times both the disease and its complications. They're also at risk of being poor and employed, lacking education, housing, good jobs, and they're particularly, and importantly in this particular case, also at risk of important political disenfranchisement, the situation of citizenship rights and so forth. And I also had personal cultural and language advantages, being South American myself, a Latina myself. Now, what's the background of my question? Why would I be interested in this question? Well, we know that poverty breeds disease and disease inequalities. We've known that probably for centuries, but at least for a couple of centuries. And we have an enormous amount of evidence, observational, epidemiological, experimental, and so forth, that this is the case, that the poor always have had worse health, and that the poorer you are, the worse your health is likely to be. And now we have this field, this academic respectable field of the social determinants of health, and this newfound interest in studying the micro and macro processes that bring about these health inequalities. I think of it as a old wine in a new academic bottle. We also have, at least in appearance, an important worldwide commitment by major social cultural institutions to eliminating health inequalities, beginning at least 35 years ago when spanning the socialist bloc and the capitalist bloc, with Alma Ata in 1971, all the way through Healthy People 2000, 2010, 2020. When we get to 2020, we'll probably release the 2030 report, given our failure to achieve these health equity. And we have a quite remarkable document released in the year 2008, stating that a girl born today can expect to live more than 80 years in some countries and not more than 45 in some others, and that this difference is just too traumatic to be morally acceptable. Therefore, social justice is a matter of life and death. This is not taken from the Communist Manifesto, but it's produced by the World Health Organization that, as you probably know, is not really a radical institution. So then the question is warranted. Why are health inequalities so resilient? And I use diabetes as a case study. Diabetes type 2, let me just clarify. There are also, one could use diabetes type 1, but it's a little bit more complicated. And we really do not know how the disease comes about. That's not true of diabetes type 2. We know very well the developmental history of the disease, the pathophysiology throughout the lifespan. So, let me give you a little bit of the theoretical background, and I don't want to get too hung up on this, but the term used to describe it is the critical functionalism. If, for those of you who have a sociology background, it's sort of a marriage between Marx and Durkheim, and how could you marry those two? Well, you kind of can't, but that's another conversation, right? This world, this perspective, this theoretical perspective looks, investigates the ideological work of certain ways of seeing the world and talking about the world and social relationships. So we examine how these ways of speaking reproduce the very problems they express concern about. And I think that that relates somehow quite well, I would say. And I see her not here, our first speaker, the points that she made. And I also draw from some more contemporary sociologies that some of you may be familiar with, American sociologist Herbert Gans and William Ryan, who worked in the 70s and 80s and had this sort of two classic papers, The Functions of Poverty and a book, Blaming the Victim, investigating educational inequalities between blacks and whites in American society. So I did this study with a couple of very young research assistants, recent graduates in sociology, so we had really sort of a blast together to sort of discovering that the goal of our investigation wasn't the one we set out to do, but rather this one. And our research site was an NGO serving Latinos in Northern California. And we interviewed people, ran focus groups, did a lot of field observations of food pantries and the food banks in particular. And we also did a more sort of quantitative dimension of our work was a community food assessment, namely looking out, going out and finding out where people did their shopping and actually calculating the comparative price of, say, tomatoes, you know, there, as opposed to what the U.S. Department of Agriculture says they ought to be when they produce, for instance, the food basket, the basic food basket. And our research questions were, what do participants believe are the causes of diabetes and health inequalities, and push to get the ultimate instance. In the ultimate instance, what do they believe causes type 2 diabetes and particularly inequalities between different population subgroups? And then what do they propose as solutions to the problem? And let me give you the punchline directly, and then I'm going to show you some quotes from our participants. Well, overwhelmingly, the causes of these health differences were found within something about individual families, the communities affected. Well, it could be their biology, could be their behavior, their psyche, their cultural imperatives, and so forth. And the solutions to type 2 diabetes and inequalities was, this is in the last instance, right? Changing something about individuals or communities affecting, or at best, you know, the radical sort of patching the system, right? How do you patch a system? Well, you kind of sort of manage poverty and oppression in the hope that health inequalities will just disappear. In other words, you do not challenge the basic structures of society that produce these power inequalities and, you know, arguably inequities in the first place. Now, there were pockets of what I call discursive resistance. People would say, well, you know, there's the role that, you know, we should, you know, act in different ways, or institutions shouldn't, you know, do this and that. And, you know, if they want to, they shouldn't tell us to go get, you know, a PhD to increase our social status. They should pay us well with the job we're doing right now, because somebody's got to pick those strawberries, you know, after all. But the pockets of discursive resistance were really, really rare. And this was true. And this is kind of I was anticipating hearing this, and when I started hearing this, I anticipated that even more, But this was true not just among the staff who attended to the client's needs, but also among the clients themselves. So let me give you some examples of this. What about, you know, defective individuals with the wrong attitude? So this is a question that we posed to a staff person. Well, the staff person was telling us, well, they start early, meaning our clients. You know, $8 an hour, oh my gosh, $8 multiplied by 10 or 10 or 12 Mexican pesos that they make at home. That's a huge amount of money, but they don't realize how expensive it is to live here. $1 is nothing, says this person, right? So we ask, we follow up and we try to push him to say something further. Well, so surely your clients have a hard time staying healthy because they're poor, no? Well, you know, my mom told us always, don't confuse poverty with laziness. That's the title of my presentation and the paper forthcoming at the International Journal of Health Services. If you're poor, you can still have a good sense of meaning, love, always respecting everybody, yourself, and people around you. It's important to have a job, and it's most important that you respect yourself. Now, this is a person who was telling us about the absolutely dreadful, you know, living conditions of these clients who crammed in homes, you know, six or seven folks per room to share a house between among a, you know, bunch of families just to make ends meet and hopefully be able to send some money back home. So there was an acknowledgement of these dramatically bad social conditions. It wasn't that those were ignored, but if you push enough, in the last instance, if only these people could get their act together and learn a bit more and get more educated, somehow their health will improve, if not, hopefully, disappear the health disparities. So this is another way in which individuals are defective. Well, they're ignorant, they just don't know. Now, this is from a client themselves. When I was running a focus group, and this person was saying, well, much of our health depends on us. So I was making this statement, you know, we know that, for instance, Latinos in the United States tend to have greater rates of diabetes than other folks, say, white, whatever that means. Right? But what do you think, why do you think that is the case? So this is an answer from a group member. Well, I think that much of our health depends on us. You can go for a walk, that's free. You can cook your own food, that's healthy. You can read, acquire information, develop good habits. That depends on each person. And that, of course, in a way, it's true, right? Now I want to say it's not true. But you see that there's a pattern here of attributing the ultimate causality of the problem to the individuals or communities affected. This is the solution piece, right? What do you do? Well, you educate them. So this is staff. I'd like to say more information directly to the people, books, classes. Now, who could oppose that, right? That sounds like a good thing. And it is a good thing in some ways. To understand where the food is coming from, what should they be eating, education. Maybe if children were taught health and nutrition, maybe they would like to try to do something about it at an early age. And this is from a client. Well, we need to change our lifestyles, raise awareness about among Latinos. And so I counter ask, you know, awareness about what? And they would say, well, for example, educate ourselves to have better lifestyles and so forth. You get the picture. This is the other solutions, patch the system. We need more money for programs for the poor. Now, let's not talk about eliminating poverty. Let's just increase the amount of programs, the number of programs for the poor. So here's a staff who says you need health education that takes in low-income communities. That's the kind of cultural competency, the white man burden in a new incarnation of the white man burden, communities of color, appropriate to reach them. Now, that is true, of course. You don't want to speak to people in a foreign language because nobody understands, neither Latinos nor Anglos, right? But you see that there's sort of a sense in which these people are different, and that ultimately bears the burden of causality and blame. And help them out to sign for more programs. So this person was explaining to me, we'll ask you a series of questions, plug in the numbers and say, oh, you know, Claudia, you're a single person, and I'm not. But anyway, looks like you might qualify for $175 a month of food stamps. Let's fill out the applications. We'll turn it in for you. Now, that's something good. You see, that's something good. I don't want to say that that's not good in the meantime. But my conclusions. finding the causes of systematic health problems and their unequal distribution, be it type 2 diabetes and its inequalities or anything else. These are systematic. It's not you and me or a third person, but on a group level and a systemic level within individuals, communities affected in the last instance, and proposing to target them as solutions to the problem reproduces the problem we purport to address, the problem of health inequalities in this particular case. Like, I was hearing a presentation yesterday about somebody describing in a healthcare system somewhere, and I'm not going to say the sinner, but just the sin, that they were coming in with this new way to ensure people, and also with they had trained community folks, community navigators they were called, to explain to these people how to navigate the system. Right, a system that, now, I think a system that requires anybody, be them or even me, to read, to go through a booklet to understand how to navigate the system itself has a problem, right? The problem is not me. The problem is the system. Change it, because nobody wants to spend time trying to learn how to navigate a complicated system. You don't make them complicated, period. That should be the way to go, at least in my opinion. Now, what does it do? What does this framing do? Well, it allows everybody to continue with business as usual, even as we are allowed a certain space to engage in a limited social critique. You know, we know the system out there, things are bad, there's a lot of injustice, and so forth. Now, why is that? Why would we continue in that, frame of mind? And the question is not for my clients, but for us, ourselves, the privileged people who are here in this room. Well, this is where the answer from critical functionalism comes into play. Inequalities are dysfunctional. That is, they're bad, they're undesirable, we don't want them, right? But who are they dysfunctional for? Well, they're dysfunctional for those who bear them. For us, the more privileged, the better off, they're somehow functional. They produce, they perform an ideological work. What ideological work? Well, this is what victim-blaming ideology is about, as articulated by what I said before, William Bryan, Herbert Gans, and so forth. This is sort of a social psychological mechanism that allows the middle class, like us, health professionals, researchers, etc., to engage in limited social critique that doesn't really pose a real threat to the system because we benefit from it. Now, we benefit from it, but we look at the inequalities, we are affected by them, we're sensitive people, we want a way that, we want to have the cake and eat it, right? We want to have it both ways. We want to continue benefiting from the system at the same time that we are kind of sort of allowed to critique it within very limited boundaries, and gives us opportunities to do or feel good, like research on the poor, as the one I did this past time, and as I said before, continue with business as usual. Now, let me tell you the limitations of my study. Of course, this was a small study. I did it on a shoestring. I had a very, very small grant, and as I said, I set out to do something else. But the power of the discourse and the repetition of it, the iterative nature of it, just drew me to these questions and conclusions. So even if the sample was not generalizable, and it was a convenient sample as well, it was still useful, I believe, to illustrate a social mechanism of language as a social institution that condones, that serves the role, the function to perpetuate the status quo. And it also, most importantly perhaps, it offers insights into forms of resistance and pathways of social change, to social change. Because I believe that different ways of thinking lead to different ways of speaking and acting eventually. So what to do? As helping professionals in the public health field, I think we can challenge a system that produces inequalities if we choose to. That is a conscious choice. We can, at the very least, refuse to cooperate ideologically, even as we relate to our patients, clients, or participants in research projects. We can do this by not calling to cope with systems of oppression and contexts of disease, but challenging them and living with the consequences of that, because that will necessarily lead to our losing some of our privileges. Transforming professional discourse can encourage political empowerment, I believe, and a transformed discourse should also recognize the limit of professional interventions, the limits of professional work, and lead us to engage with other forms of practice, including social movements and people power. I heard in a union meeting recently that there's really two forms of power in society: there's power of money and the power of the people. And we need to choose. We need to simply choose whose side we are on. And real social change, closing with the precaution of Herbert Gans, will also very likely require that the powerless acquire enough power to demand it. So that's what I have for you today, and thank you very much. And I think that we have quite a bit of time for the speakers to come to the front, and we can sit and have a conversation. So let me ask the leaders of the Socialist Caucus here, how should we do this?
We have an audience.
Okay. So you guys stay in the back? Okay. This is my first time, in case you didn't know. I'm going to sit over there.
Oh,
okay. Whatever. My stuff is over there.
Yeah.
You sit
over there. So we'll let Martha kind of come to the questions. Maybe since I'm parking out, I'll go ahead and ask one. We heard about, from one of our speakers, about how we talk about these things, how we discuss these things is important. And I heard from the next person that, yes, that's true, and we need to change. So I'm just wondering if our first speaker can respond to our last speaker in terms of those issues. Where did you hear resonance in the messages between what you were trying to tell us about how we're looking at things and what Claudia was telling us about what we need to do as professionals if we truly want to make change?
Go to the mic.
Sure. Well, we could. I could.
Or just
pat
it or down, maybe. Could we?
Yeah. Oops. Perfect. Almost perfect.
There, we make it work here. Thank you. I really enjoyed both your presentations, and a lot of what you were saying was very much resonating with my piece. And I think as public health professionals, then the challenge is, how do you get the voices of the people to come out front and center, and not just have the voices out there, but to honor what they are saying, and maybe even to go beyond it, to look at the root causes of these inequalities. And we have a nifty term, social determinants of health, now in public health, but then the challenge for me is, what do you do about those social determinants of health, and to what extent do we have the tools to address the social determinants of health, and are we training our next generation public health professionals, our students, into addressing the social determinants of health? And as you know, to even go there, you need like heavy intersectoral cooperation. And I honestly don't feel very confident that we are at that stage where we understand this intersectoral cooperation between transportation, between our economy, between public policy, et cetera, to even figure out what skills we need and how we're going to train the next generation professionals. So I don't have answers for you. I just have more questions and, in a sense, a sense of what direction we really need to go. Because essentially we're saying, okay, there is the behavior stuff, which is more downstream. And interestingly, in your interviews, the community folks were focusing on behavior as an issue that was essentially hurting them without necessarily looking beyond. And I think the last quote that you gave with Herbert Gans is, it's only when the people have come to a point where they have embraced or understand this inequality can they even change it, and maybe that's where the sources are there. So how do you create social activism where the community understands the root causes of inequality, and perhaps they are the ones who are going to push us? But if we're going to push it, then maybe we have a room full of professionals here, and maybe you guys have some insight. So I answered the question with several other questions.
Okay. Anybody else? I'm just going to
field the questions, yeah?
I want to come back to the first speaker. You mentioned a checklist. How is that? This is a kind of just a quick terminological question. I have a more important question after this. How is that related to political correctness?
In some ways, it is related, and in some ways, I think it is real. So there is a false piece to it, which is, to me, a political correctness of what's appropriate and what's not appropriate. And at another level, it is real, right? I mean, I think people need to know what's appropriate and not appropriate among people from another culture, right? I mean, if I don't eat pork, I think it's important for the providers, for public health professionals, to know that I don't eat pork and don't insult me by offering me a dish that has pork in it. But so that's the real piece. But okay, but the not so real piece is the political correctness, where we sanitize things to the point where we don't want to say what really is going on, and you put it within a PC context, and so they're both together happening.
Okay, thank you. And I want to ask you a somewhat more important question about the category of race. The census now is allowing people to self-identify, but it is almost a decade since the Human Genome Project reported that there is no genetic basis whatsoever for race. There is a gene for skin color, probably modifiable over generations. You need dark skin in the tropics to prevent skin cancer, and you need lighter skin in Europe or the North to get vitamin D, so forth. How long are we going to be not addressing this complete destruction of any kind of biological basis for race? I mean, are we going to keep relying on social constructionism or critical race theory as it was originally formulated by Delgado, I think, and others? Or are we going to actually try and build on what the geneticists were able to determine?
Okay, I'll give you fairly, I mean, we can spend all afternoon talking about this, but okay, the two pieces to it. I mean, so on one hand, genetically, yes, they are no distinct races, right? So that's there. I mean, there are as much within race differences as they are between race differences, so that's there. But having said that, races are really powerful sociopolitical construct that has amazing implications on how we socially and politically classify people and how we create life chances or the lack thereof in the access to valued resources. And because of those inequities, structural inequities that exist, we create health disparities. So on one hand, we say race is not real in terms of being scientific, but it's extremely real in the power of us as a society doling out resources or taking away from people. And so that subordination and oppression is extremely powerful. And maybe there will come a day where we will not see people differently because of the way they look, which unscientifically, as you know, is connected to this unscientific concept of race. But until we get to that day where race ceases to be an issue, where we cease to rank people, judge people, value people differently because of the way they look, then we can start, or we can maybe move away from the concept of race. So colorblindness is in itself deeply racist because you're denying the fact that racism does exist. Right.
What she said. But I just want to toss in one other piece, and that is when I'm sorry, I'm Martha Livingston. I work with the Socialist Caucus, and I'm butting in here because you don't want to ask me, you want to ask them. But when I first started teaching this stuff 22 years ago, one of my elders said, why do you have race on your course outline? It's not race, it's racism. And so I changed that. And I think that really helps get to the heart of the dispute. And so I teach my students, race does not exist biologically. It's one of the most powerful social determinants of health. Next question.
Yes, and your name is?
Dave
Spira. Dave. And, well, you know, that's a good point. You need to help them cope because they don't go for you to get a political analysis. But there's a way of helping them to cope, I think, and I do my best, I don't always succeed, that gives them that sort of key to the sociological imagination, that ability articulated by Seawright Bills to connect your own biography within the political and historical context within which that biography happens. You don't even have to use these words, but make them realize that it's no fault of their own, although at the same time you gotta work to give them the enough, you know, energy and I hate the word empowerment because it's been very polluted as well with the political correctness thing. It all seems as if it depended on empowering people to pull themselves up by their own bootstraps, which is of course absurd. But in a way, I think you can have that double function of using some of the humility that the other speaker was Shireen, talking about, you know, to say, you know what, you've been drawn a bad, you know, a bad draw, right? So this explains your position. Now let me tell you how I can help you. If you can, sometimes you won't be able to, right? Somebody who's homeless, you can help them, you know, get health care, but unless you give them a home, there's no solution to their deep-rooted problem, right? And it's not a bad thing to work with homeless people to have them better, but the truth is we should have no homelessness, right? That job should disappear. So it is difficult. I don't have the answer to that. I think that the attitude that one adopts as an investigator, a clinician, a social worker, and so forth, has an important role to play in giving back to people a sense, in helping them recover a sense of dignity that the social structures have so well undermined. And I don't know if I addressed your point.
Yes. That's a good point. When I put it into that multivariate model, gender did not come out to be significant, so I dropped it.
But in the bivariate model,
You know, if you just put gender in the model by itself, I don't know if it would come out to be significant or not. But you know, when you put everything into the model, you're adjusting for everything else.
Right.
So it may be that there's something else in there that's responsible for the gender. But as far as being diagnosed for diabetes, I don't think that there's a significant difference. But I'd have to look at that. That's a good point.
Yes?
One thing that makes me around the thought is I just feel like a much larger umbrella here is, I mean, although race and ethnicity are kind of most, you know, prominent and egregious, but I'm not sure how to articulate this, but I mean, we live in a corporate agenda. It's occurred to me for a long time the way we look at risk factors for cancer are very individualized. And if that really determines who gets the money and what gets studied. And, you know, the impact of Dow Chemical on the environment, the top study is a lot more complex and more difficult to study. And so we look at individual risk factors, and I think that that is
So thank you for volunteering that comment, and I wanted to show you this from the Pan American Health Organization, PAHO, that's the Organisation Panamericana de la Salud, right? Key messages of non-communicable diseases. Not a word on Dow Chemical. Not a word on, you know, unhealthy diet. There's not a word on food corporations, right? Unhealthy diet, harmful use of alcohol. You know that Frederick Engels, when he wrote his Conditions of the Working Class in England in 1830s, right, he talked about alcoholism as a, not as an individual problem, as a result of the appalling work conditions in the, borne by the English working class, right? So they're not going to read Frederick Engels because he's a communist after all, right? So, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And this is a message to the world, right, for the Latin American nations, right, us. So it is indeed a hegemonic way of thinking, to the point that many, many times we find ourselves talking that language without even realizing, until you become sensitized. You know, sociology has done that for me, but it can find it in any, you know, other number of ways. And what I particularly have been somehow inadvertently very maybe trained to see or to identify are the silences. And when you identify the things that are not being said, that's when your eye becomes sharper, and then of course you become more irritable against these things. You really, you know, you get start getting angry all the time, right? So and I don't know how we can collectively move you know, beyond that. Maybe some of the images I put there are probably the only way. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not going to happen through voting, Democrat, Republican, and so forth. You know, they're going to happen in the streets. That's my opinion. And maybe what we can do is encourage the more downtrodden to, or join them, not encourage them, but join them when they go out in the street.
Just to add here, and my bias is that I'm a sociologist as well, so there you go. So we're speaking the same language almost. But I think the challenge here is, okay, so a discipline like sociology pushes against this more individualistic approach to problems, period. That in many ways signifies what the dominant discourse is about. I mean, we're by and large very individualistic in our approach to everything, not just health. Pull yourself by a bootstrap, et cetera, you know, then you track it back to capitalism, et cetera. But then now the challenge is for public health then to move beyond this more downstream individualistic behavior modification obsession that we have. I mean, much of what we are focused on, if you just look at our program book in there, I mean, I love public health, but I mean, it's behavior, and I even teach a class on health behavior, and it just drives me nuts because there's so little behavior theory that look at structural inequity. So I lined up, you know, using the standard textbooks, and I lined up talking about, okay, helpfully modeled, et cetera, which are useful, but I think you still are not addressing the more upstream structural factors in there that sociology talks loudly about. And so to the extent that this caucus and others can move that piece, that discourse, and maybe then partner with communities who are disenfranchised through, say, participatory action research, for example, to kind of bring those two voices together, because you cannot have a top-down, you know, elitist group like us. I mean, we are elitist as far as educational status goes, to be speaking for underserved communities, but working with communities, acknowledging that they are huge number of challenges that communities are dealing with, right? Especially if you have diabetes or any kind of chronic condition. So acknowledging that they are coping things that one needs to do to survive, but moving that to a higher level of political activism where we are questioning the very structures that are creating the Dow Chemicals, that are creating the problems that we, you know, run around trying to solve. And maybe we'll all be out of a job, right? But that's the danger of all of this.
We live for the day. I think one word that needs to be added to the discussion of your really good point is the word class. And that is to say, and you know, stop me because this is a rant that once I get started, I could be doing this for hours. But it isn't racism or class, yeah? Racism functions in large part, though not exclusively, through class, through a class mechanism. And remember Nancy Krieger's wonderful article, Does Racism Harm Health? Did Child Abuse Exist Before 1962? And her point was that if you don't have a name for something, you can't even begin to study it and change what needs changing. And so we have so little work on how class works to affect our health status in the United States, and even less work on how class and racism work together to shape health status and to depress life chances. And that's really the direction we need to go. Yes?
I'm just wondering quickly if I know you and academics have a worry about social determinants of health becoming co-opted in the same sense of a checklist, like in my normative MPH program, as people start to talk about it more, they're not talking about critical theory and they just don't have it in their vocabulary. So in my program, it's a struggle even when people become aware of social determinants of health because it's another little box that nobody can afford.
Thank you for your point, because that's probably the norm in public health programs. But let me say something. It needn't be that way. That's the first thing to realize, and probably students are in the best position to challenge that. It needn't be that way, because it's not even in the roots of public health. Because public health is a field, as you probably know, was born in the beginning of the 19th century. And I mentioned one of the authors, Frederick Engels, but there's others, right? Louis Villermé, and so forth, and all of them acknowledged, you know, that it was a structural inequality, power inequalities, and so forth, that were at the root of the poor health working class. Another thing that has disappeared from the discourse is the word working class. We don't have a working class here. All the politicians panted to the middle class. That's the idea. That's the erasure of class by talking about middle class. So you students, of course, you're in a delicate position, but you don't have to accept that. You can push the questions in class further, which is why I almost dropped I said, I work on the social determinants of health, and I realized that I was working in a totally conventional field. So I call it now the political economy of the social determinants of health, which is a mouthful, right? I mean, who wants to hear that much? But I don't like the term anymore. I've dropped it because it's just very conventional. It's accept the status quo and then works within it. And it doesn't even think that the different world is possible.
Mm-hmm. No, you're absolutely right. That is a very good insight in there. Because what is happening now is that co-opting with FDOH. So we feel good. We have it out there. We have a little checklist. And the same way by which we have race as a variable, right? Mm-hmm. You don't really understand what that means and why do we have these inequities in there, and what are the pathways by which this is causing poor health, and more importantly, the solutions of it, which are very challenging, and you have to go up against essentially changing the status quo. But I think we need more people to ask exactly the question that you asked, you know, SDOH, and what does it mean, and what are we doing with it? Because that's exactly what is going to happen. I mean, we feel good that we have it on there as a little item, and, you know, okay, we're talking about upstream variables, happy, and we all go home. But, so, keep up the good questions.
Okay, we probably have time for one more question. Anybody? Yeah.
Unless you would prefer to make a closing comment, because I think that if you go back and actually look at the title of this session, which is Health Justice, Healthcare Justice, we can't get there from where we are now. You know, an unjust society, you can't have just health care. It's going to happen. So, you know, you can't swim in a sewer and come out clean. Part of our job is to point out the injustice inside society as a whole, as teachers of both public health or of our other professional allied or colleagues. I mean, we have to raise these issues continuously in their consciousness, and we need to act in a way that demonstrates that we recognize the injustice, whether it's in the streets or in our public discourse or in our private discourse.
I just want to get back to something about how do clinicians work, based on what John just said. That's John Ross of Socialist Caucus, who just made those comments. And that is, I'm not a clinician. I teach, so I do get to talk one-on-one with regular folk who have been affected by our social system. And I think that as a clinician, the most painful piece must be how folks internalize their own oppression. I'm sick with diabetes. Why? Not because I live in an unjust social system where a healthy, quote-unquote, lifestyle isn't even a possibility, but because somehow I have failed. I've failed to become wealthier, and I've failed to exercise, and I've failed to eat healthy foods when a buck can buy me a McNasty burger, but it won't buy me a side order of vegetables, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So how you work with people and get them to stop that internalization and move toward a more just solution. I think that's really difficult for clinicians.
We're too downstream. Too busy patching up the injured bodies. And so it's hard to move back upstream when you're busy.
Okay, so one more hand in the back.
I just have to say something in that regard. I am a clinician, so obviously this is something that I'm interested in because I'm here. And I did my public health degree many, many years ago, so I don't even remember all the theories well. But I work in an emergency setting, and I have, you know, patients who come in who may have a glucometer but don't use it, live near a grocery store but still continue, you know, to practice the cultural eating pattern that they've learned from childhood. And I feel like there must be a bridge, like extending this from a population perspective, but also kind of manifesting some type of education or intrinsic desire to change one's norms also. I don't know if you all would consider this an aspect of blaming the victim, but I find so many people content to live the way they're living. And I find myself more disturbed by what they're doing and what's going on around them than they are. And I just wonder if you guys have any guidance on discussions or things that clinicians can do to help in this process.
Well, that's a hard one. I'm not sure. I don't think that this is just pure speculation, right? If any of the folks you see, you know, were able to live in, you know, the Upper West Side in Manhattan, they would choose not to. In other words, if they were able to, you know, work half the time and earn 10 times as much, or what was the last ratio, CEO, average worker, 3.24, something like that? I don't think that any of them would turn down the opportunity, so I don't quite, you know, think that that is the case, that what you're articulating really captures the you know, the totality of the structural, you know, power differentials that lead certain people who are constrained by certain ways of life to do certain things. For instance, you know, a 2-minute break, you go out and smoke a cigarette. What else are you going to do? I mean, you can't go to Hawaii, right, because you don't have the money. So cigarettes is the second best thing that you can do. So I try to sort of refrain from that, as I was telling Dave before, for that kind of judgment. When I was telling that before, the best I could do, and I did not work with a very disempowered population, I worked with a real middle class population as a clinician. Now, as an investigator in sociology, I'm continuously exposed to people who are extremely disenfranchised, right? So I do try to help them, you know, recover that sense of dignity. I'm no better than you. I've just been very lucky. Mm-hmm. And let me tell you a few of the things that you might choose to do, if you so choose to do, that might help you, or ask them, you know, How can I help you? How do you think I can help you make your life better? That's even, you know, sort of a better way, which I can't always do when I'm constrained by a research, plan. But given that I do a lot of qualitative research, I'm quite free to change things. Or I'm quite free, as I did with this small project, to go out and get money to do certain things and end up doing others without telling them out loud. So I'm not sure if I'm addressing the point, but I try to refrain from doing that kind of judgment myself.
Just a quick comment to add to that. I'm not a clinician, I'm a sociologist, I've always been a sociologist. But I think really it's not an either or kind of approach that we need to take. I mean, health problems, social problems are very complex. And to understand that a lot of health behavior and approaches to health are not to a large, but okay, sociology bias, stopping to a large part determined by your social environment, your social conditions, you know, your level of hopelessness, you don't have any idea of what's out there, etc. And so at that level, health education is helpful. And so we're not saying all this downstream behavioral health education, etc. stuff is not helpful. It is helpful. But in many ways, that's just survival. That's more band-aid. That's helping you to just get your head above the water and tread water for a little while. But that's not really giving you a long-term solution, which then you need to go upstream and change the whole system. And so maybe within the clinical context, it would hugely benefit people, I would imagine, for health education to take place. I mean, when I was in the Center Reducing Health Disparities, we used to do a lot of health education, and people were extremely happy and grateful and thankful that we opened their eyes, that there were different ways of doing things, that there would be services out there. They just didn't think about it because they're just so used to doing things there, you know, just in terms of routine. So I think looking at intervention or solutions at multiple levels is really what we need to be doing. And the problem, my mind is that we're too focused on downstream, too focused, as Urban Zola talked about, you know, pulling the people out of the water and resuscitating them in the $1 billion healthcare system that we have without asking the question, who's pushing them into the water upstream? I mean,
yep.
So.